If I could do anything I wanted to, when the long day of work is over, laying in bed and reliving the struggles of the day over and over, I'd tune into Joey Reynolds and immediately become engrossed in his personality and his unique view of the human condition. I'd let him capture my mind with humor, with philosophy, interesting discussions with interesting people, as he pulls my mind away from my cares, as he sends tendrils of love across the dark emptiness of the night, reaching out. I'd let him ease my concern about myself by encouraging me to be concerned with the plight of others. That's what I'd do if I could do anything I wanted to.
Yeah, if I could do anything I wanted, I would probably tell esoteric jokes. You know, those are above everybody's head. Because, to be honest about it, all of these politicians are a joke. You know, and it's all above my head because I can't believe anybody allows these speeches to be heard on the radio and television. Except there's one part that I really do believe, and that is that we make a lot of money when they buy time. And I think that's really good because these scoundrels deserve to spend their money on something as foolish as my show. So I'd love to have Hillary buy time. I think she ought to be doing time. and the other one, you know, Obama and the Giuliani, you don't hear a lot about anymore because he's down in Florida, you know. Well, it's winter time for Jews. So, you know, I mean, he's going to be down there trying to get that New York vote. This is a tough audience, you know, when you're in New York. See, we're a liberal city, but we're not stupid. And, you know, we didn't like him on 9/10. But 9/11, we all liked him because he was in the front page of the Daily News and the Post, and he was helping everybody. See, but that's what they ought to do all the time. All these guys need to be doing that all the time. But, you know, I don't want to tell them how to live. Listen, then I'd be in charge. See, if I told them how to live, then I would be the king above the president. Maybe we need to have a king. You know, maybe we need to have some sort of royalty in this society. Now, you know, I will tell you this. I'm not the guy, just so you know, because I change my mind every day. I'm a little flaky. I'm crazy. And I also really would kill them if they didn't do what I want them to do. And my kids can't live with me. My ex-wife, she calls me once a month. And you know, that's okay. But having me in charge of something, I'm not the right guy. I did go to work once with my daughter. I had her come and be part of my business. And I think I was wrong. And another thing is to work with your wife. Boy, that's the worst thing. I don't know how Hillary's going to do it. This would be the third term for Clinton, won't it? So, you know, I was thinking that when, think about this one on the way home, folks, this will be his third term. But, we're looking at this country being in the toilet right now. And instead of pulling the big flush handle, which some countries want to do, we got to start thinking about how we're going to go to the people who really do have some sort of imagination and some answers, and we got to do things differently. You know, the thing that comes to my mind immediately is therapy. This whole country's in recovery right now. And we all need to get to the 12-step meetings. We need to go to America Anonymous. And everybody's got to do a 12-step program so that we can get sober. And then come to the place where you can't give something away unless you have it. So I don't know what the hell we're doing with a war in another place trying to teach them how to live when we can't live ourselves here. That's the truth of that matter. And, you know, the fact, too, is that in therapy, the first thing they tell you just about, I mean, I've been through a lot of them, is that the definition of insanity is to do the same thing and expect different results. So this is what I can't understand because I have enough therapy in me. I don't know why we're repeating the same behavior and we're expecting it to end differently. You know, the movie's always going to be the same until you change the players in it and until you move it around and change the furniture and do the scenes differently and do the lighting, you know, at least change the lighting on this country. We're not even doing that. The sound sucks. But, you know, we got to really make a better movie. And we could do it. See, now this is we're at a time where serenity meets calamity. We're right there in the center of the road. We're middle of the road right now because this is the storm warning. You got everything is just about ready to fall apart if we don't do the right thing. And it can also go the other way. If we start to get together on everything, we can pull it out. Now, That's a speech of hope. And I'm not hearing any of that. I'm hearing everybody narcissistically wanting the job because they want the job. You know, this is not a American Idol. We're not looking for a guy who's the best. You know, I mean, if we were doing that, we'd have Simon on the side narrating all of these convention things, you know, or whatever they call it, these conferences. Why are we having elections every day anyway? Who the hell ever thought that was a good idea? And who cares what New Hampshire thinks? Nobody cares about it if you go up there, except they got nice lobsters. Nobody really gives a damn about New Hampshire. It's pretty, you know, and it's a nice drive when the leaves change. But nobody cares about politically what they think. I mean, this is not a brain trust. And Carolinas, I mean, you know, come on. These are the guys we used to fight. We're not interested in what Florida thinks. Florida got us this last president with those false votes. You know, I mean, why would we think about any of these places as being important? I just debunked a lot of it for you. I mean, there's no credibility in anything, is there? So the only savior that's going to come out of this whole thing is me, because I'm the one that's telling you the truth right now on the air. But you know what? I'm the most unpopular guy when I do this with management, because the radio station lives off of all of this crap. They live off of it. This could very easily be WKRP. Crap. Because what we do, you know, with Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, who's not on our station here in New York, but we're on some stations with all these. I'm on with all these guys. Probably the only other guy that's similar to me would be Neil Boris. I think he's probably close. They say, is there a guy down in Atlanta? What's his name? Florida?
Neil Boris.
Who's the one down in Atlanta? There's a guy in Atlanta that kind of talks sense.
Schultz?
I don't know. But the fact is that, you know, they're making a living out of all this. They get on the air, and you got to take it as entertainment. You can't be taking this as news. We're putting our values in the wrong place. If you're listening to the radio and you expect me to give you information based on facts, I'm the wrong guy. I only know what I hear, and I don't hear real well. Remember when I sat in for O'Reilly and they said they'd never have me do it again? You know why? Because I wouldn't argue with people. Whatever they said, I said, yeah, that's all right. They don't want that. No, I'm serious about this part, though. I think we got a chance to bring some stuff back to, you know, some value back to our country. Now here's the good news. Here's the good news. Let me move this around here. First of all, when people hit a bottom, they usually change, and we figure it out so that we can do things in a more spiritual fashion. You know, you move your life in the direction of the divine or the way that you really know inside is right. So you go inside. And that's soul searching, you know. And some people don't want to ever do that. They're in denial, and some people are afraid that they're going to find a demon inside or a bunch of them. So they don't do the inside job easily. So we live in this cosmetic bubble where it's ephemeral. You know, all the outside gets fixed and nothing on the inside gets addressed easily until you have a catastrophic illness. You know you're going to die. If you're sitting in hospice, I'll bet you make peace with somebody. And I will also bet you that if you're in prison, you do a lot of thinking. So, you know, there's a place for everybody to come to grips with this and get real. The get real part is what we're having a hard time with in this country, because we're so spoiled, and we've also done it to our kids, and they're used to having comforts. We don't know how to do without. We don't like to hear the word no. We get our own way. We're luxurious, you know. I mean, we live in excess. We have more than we need. Nobody needs, in any country, a Costco. You know, I mean, you don't need to bring home 400 rolls of toilet paper and 12 jugs of Tide. The prison laundry doesn't do that. You know, I mean, you know, we don't need all of this. This is all part of want, because we are afraid probably that we're not going to have more. That's probably it. I mean, deep down inside, there's something that says I lack. I'm not enough, and there's not enough. That's probably psychologically what's going on. But this is far too therapeutic. I mean, you know, you shouldn't be listening to my show to hear this. The thing that I want to get across to you is, simply put, there is great hope. General Motors, when I went to the Consumer Electronics Show last week, and they wheel out the new cars, we can do it. I mean, I saw this, the hydrogen car, which gets 160 miles to a tank of it, zero emissions, rides like a beauty. I took it up the West Side Highway in New York, and it was over all the potholes, zoomed past the cab drivers. It's a wonderful experience. Big television screen in front so that you could see, you know, the nav system, the OnStar, the XM, and all this other crap, you know. Plus, even my show sounds good on it. So, you know, I'm driving this thing up and down the West Side Highway, and I'm saying, why don't we all have one of these? It's perfect. No emissions, no fumes, no sound. The thing they need to remove from the car is the horn in New York. I mean, that's the instrument of destruction. That horn has got to go. I mean, it's of no value because nobody moves anyway. And what's the difference? You're blowing it only because you're anxious. You know, you're anxious. So the General Motors people now, they have OnStar, can slow vehicles down when it's on a high police chase. So you don't have to worry about stolen cars. They know where it is all the time. And if someone takes your car, O.J. Simpson needed this. They could have slowed that sucker down and saved us a half a day of watching television where he was taking us on a ride with Roosevelt Greer on the highways in California. Slow that vehicle down. See, they can do it now by satellite, by OnStar. General Motors, the company that you would think is going to die and can't do it anymore. See, what did it was they hit a bottom. And they realized that they're going to be in the toilet if they didn't do something. So now they're better than the Germans and the Japs. So finally, you know, the thing is on the comeback trail. And I got that CTS car, which is got all the bells and whistles. It's still fuel, but it's efficient. You know, it's about 26, 30 miles a gallon of gas. Not good enough. You know, and the hybrid, the Escalade is going to be a hybrid. So I talked to Rick Wagner, who's the chairman of the company, in Las Vegas last week or so ago. And I'm telling you, you know, we can do it when we want it. There's a guy who did it for business, corporation. And it's being done. And I can give you countless examples, people on the show, whether it's Steve Wozniak, who was the inventor of the computer, and Camp Woz, he's doing with his money. You know, there's one after the other of people who are stunning in progress. And we can do it. But not with this kind of leadership. You know, these are clowns. We need Judy Collins to sing the new national anthem, Send in the Clowns. We'll be right back.
710 WOR. Real life, real people, real talk radio.
So it was my little esoteric joke is that the Tao is down, according to four Tibetan monks. We're on the air here live with our radio show tonight, and we got Paul Cicero here. He's the author of You Have No Right Here. I love that. So, Paul, you're listening to me rant a little bit there for a while. Or is it riffing?
Riffing.
Yeah. You know, I just went all over the place.
Well, I think you're right about Florida. They're all down our way now, and the airwaves are full of all that talk.
Well, now, you're from where originally? Canada?
I'm originally Canada, near Toronto.
Yeah, me too. You know, I'm from Buffalo.
Sure.
Which is near Toronto.
Used to live in St. Catharines, 10 miles from there, and used to listen to WKBW.
Oh, no. Another one of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
He graduated. So you were in prison for a while, huh?
I was, for 3 years in the Middle East.
Yeah, what'd you do? Did you have drugs in the... Well, you weren't in a Turkish prison, though, were you?
I was in... country called the United Arab Emirates, of which you've likely heard of Dubai.
Sure.
It's one of the main cities in that country. And this all happened back in 1998. You may recall that in August of 1998, our embassies were bombed in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in Africa. And President Clinton retaliated by bombing a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan and a terrorist camp in Afghanistan at the time. And many years before that, I met a friend from the Far East who visited me when I was living in Florida. And while I was working over in the Middle East, he kept in touch. And that particular summer, he said, why don't we meet up for a vacation? So we decided to meet up in Greece. And we did. And what was striking from the first moment I met him was that he had adopted this anti-American attitude in response to our bombing in retaliation for embassies being bombed. And I was the American he knew, closest one at hand, and he took it all out on me. He just started hitting me as like, you guys are all warmongers and you got nothing better to do. And he just tore into me from day one. And the first day we were together for a full day, he kind of let off for a while, and we had a good time. And that night I found out my mother had died, so I had to go back to Canada for 10 days. So yeah. I rejoined him for the last 2 days of our vacation. And when I got back to Athens, you know, he wanted to go party and have a good time, and I was depressed and had jet lag, and I really didn't want to do that. And he said, here, this will help. And he pulled out a little bit of cocaine.
Yeah.
And reluctantly and stupidly, I shared it with him. We went out that night. And the next morning, he went right back into his tirade about the ugly Americans and warmongers. And we got into a big fight, and our friendship dissolved. He went his way, I went my way. And I flew back to Abu Dhabi in the Middle East. And when I got back to customs, where I'd been many times because I traveled the Middle East extensively, I went up to customs, and the guy said to me, anything to declare? And I said no. And he said, where'd you come from? And I said, well, I came from Bahrain, which was a transfer point. He said, no, before Bahrain. I said, well, from Athens. And his comment to me was, ah, yes. Just like that. Like, I've been waiting for you. Kind of, ah, yes. And he said, I want to look in your black bag. And I was carrying a black bag, a brown bag, and a green backpack. He said, I want to look in your black bag. So I had nothing to hide, so opened my black bag, and I just got it unzipped. And he said, no, it's not that one. And at that moment, I had this chill up my spine, like there's something really going on here. And he said, it's the green backpack. He said, take it off, unzip it. I unzipped it, and he said, stand back. And he searched in my bag, and he pulled out this little black toiletries bag. And it's one of these oblong-shaped bags with a zipper across the top and the ends fold under. And he said, open it. So I opened it, and there was a toothbrush and toothpaste. And I said, that's all there is. And he said, well, I'm not so sure. So he said, stand back. And he reached in under one of the ends of the little black toiletries bag, and he pulled out the little glass vial that my friend had had the cocaine in. And there were just like a few little grains still stuck to the bottle. And he said, what's this? And all I could do was stammer out, it's just a prescription. You can see it's empty. It was in a little brown-colored bottle. And he said, I'm not so sure. And he said, just a minute. And he took off the lid, put his fingers to his mouth, touched the lid, tasted it, and he said, this is cocaine. He said, close your bags and follow me. And from there on, I was taken into a room, and I was strip searched, and my clothes were cut open. My running shoes were cut open, and he was looking for more drugs. I said, I don't know what the heck you're looking for. I said, I didn't even know this was there. And when I saw it, I realized that it had been planted on there by my friend. And
he's not a friend.
Not anymore.
Wasn't a friend then.
No. And it was just a bad 2 weeks all around with what he did.
Well, did he think you were an ugly Canadian?
Well, I think
the ugly American thing didn't apply to you anyway.
Well, I was traveling on my American passport at the time.
I see.
Yeah, I'm an American citizen now. So I don't think he realized to what extent the damage would be done. And I thought he'd just, you know, get me in trouble for a while and that would be it. And what it led to was I was interrogated that night, and I was taken in the middle of the night in the back of a pickup truck with a wire, barbed wire thing over it, down through Abu Dhabi, and put into this hole, like the black hole of Calcutta. It was filthy and smelly. And
you would have done better in Calcutta.
Maybe.
Hold on for a minute. We'll be right back. Joey Reynolds Show, live from New York.
710 WOR, Real Talk Radio.
Paul Cicero is here. He's the author of You Have No Right Here. Now, he was traveling through the Middle East before it was dreadful. Or has it always been dreadful?
I think it likely always has been, but I had been working there and living there for about a year prior to this. And
why were you there?
I got a job working for some sheikhs in Abu Dhabi who owned the franchise rights to some American English language schools, where we taught English as a second language. And initially, they sent me to their Kuwait school, which
where there's money.
Where there's lots of money. And, but there's a lot of competition, too, in that market. And the school only had one full-time teacher and was on the verge of closing. And the president said, Paul, we want you to go there and save the school. So within 5 months, I had signed the biggest contract in the country for English language teaching. We got the Kuwaiti military signed up. And the school went from one teacher to 33 in a matter of 5 or 6 months. So they moved me to Abu Dhabi, which was their headquarters, and I became director of marketing for all the Middle East and North Africa. So from then on, I started traveling the Middle East and got to see a lot.
First class, too.
First class. And it was a really good experience for me. I got to see.
Al Airlines is not there.
It is not.
No. So when you were traveling around, were you on any one of the Prince's planes?
No, I wasn't.
DC-9s? I've been on that. That's why I'm asking. Fawood Al-Saad. I've been on that DC-9 when I worked for Wayne Newton. That's my one little frame of reference.
Okay.
But I remembered how they lived in there. You know, it was a big living room on the plane, probably like the presidential jet.
Yeah. No, I traveled like every other businessman and traveled the regular airlines. And this one night was just something right out of...
Out of hell.
Out of hell.
You mean where you were betrayed by a friend. You had a vial of seeds of cocaine. Well, little sediment.
Little grains, yeah. And I'd flown in and out of the airport dozens of times, so I knew what you could and could not do. And I would never have done that myself because it was foolish.
So he planted it in your little bag, and they pulled it out, and they took you off to prison right away.
Took me off to
a hole.
It was a holding jail, actually.
Yeah, until what? Until there was a hearing?
Well, actually, I was supposed to be at work that next morning, and I knew that my secretary would be one, you know, where I was, because I was always the first one at work every day anyway. And
did you speak their language?
A little bit, but I had a translator that worked with me a lot when I made calls on the ministries and whatnot.
Because you were teaching English.
Yes. And my job was not to teach, but to market. So I had a really good translator and who went around with me.
Do you have anybody explain your situation?
Well, no one knew for about 5 days.
Oh, I see.
They kept me. When I was being interrogated at the airport, I said, when I realized what was going on and the what kind of a mess I was in, I said, I need to speak to my embassy and I need a lawyer. And that's when the gentleman said to me, you have no rights here, hence the title of my book.
Yeah.
And so when I was put in this jail, I demanded to see the embassy. And they said, well, they've been called. They'll be here. And again, they interrogated me. And they said, you need to sign this document. After I answered all these questions, they showed me this document in Arabic. I said, I don't know what it says. I can't really sign it. I said, well, you're not going anywhere until you sign this thing. So I signed it, and it was foolish, and I was put in this hole. And after 4 more days, you know, I was beside myself. This was a hellhole where all the prisoners collectively ate off a common plate where everybody dug their hands into the food, and there was one common hole in the ground for the toilet, and it just smelled to high heavens. And on the fifth morning, I just kind of lost it, and I started screaming at the front gate saying, I need to see the embassy. And One of the Indian fellows who spoke Arabic, he said, let me handle this for you. And he talked to the guard. And short time later, a couple of policemen came and took me out, put me in a white van, drove me back into town. And I saw this sign that said Sharia Court. So I knew I was going to court right away. And they took me to this room. They opened the door, and there was a man in a white dishdasha, which is like a white flowing robe, sitting there flanked by two civilians. Turns out one civilian was a translator and one was recording what I said. And he started asking me questions. And through the interpreter, he said, you're being charged with using drugs, importing drugs, importing with the intent to distribute. I said, this is crazy for what little bit there was there. And I said, how much was there? He said, there was 1/5,000th of an ounce, which is... couldn't do anything to anybody. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. And he said, well, and what was funny at the moment was the translator said to me, he says, you know, I've lived in Miami for several years, and everybody in Miami does cocaine. And I said, you're just so wrong. And I said, you know, most Americans don't do drugs like that as a common routine. And
why would you have such a severe charge? I mean, that you didn't they didn't have any evidence.
They had nothing but that.
Yeah.
I had admitted that I'd used it, and they said my urine test came back positive. And at first I thought, well, I should never have admitted that, but later on when I got to court, it proved to be very valuable to me that I did admit it. And before I gave any information to the public prosecutor in that room, I went into a tirade and I said, I'm not going to talk to you people. He says, I want to talk to my embassy. And he says, well, you're not going to get a phone call until you give us a statement. I said, I've already given a statement. I've given two statements. He said, well, this is the public prosecutor. You've got to give us a statement. And I ranted and raved. And finally, I agreed that I would give a statement. We talked. They wrote down what I said. And at the end, again, he said, you got to sign this. And I said, I don't know what you've written. He said, sign it. You get a phone call. And I knew by then my family would have been alerted and everybody would be wondering where Paul was. So I signed it. They gave me the phone. I dialed the only number I knew, which was my manager. Thank goodness he was there. And when he heard my voice, he said, Paul, where are you? We've been looking everywhere for you. The embassies searched all the hospitals on your route. We've checked with all the embassies out of the country. We've checked the airport. We found your car. It hasn't been touched. Your apartment is still like you left it. It's obvious you weren't back home.
Thank God it wasn't Sprint. You would have had a dropout right then.
Exactly.
So what did you do?
Well, I as far as I got. And the door burst open. These two policemen had taken me there, saw me on the phone. They ran over. They grabbed me. They dragged me across the room. And I held onto the phone as long as I could until the cord pulled it out of my ear.
So they didn't know where you were?
They did not know
where
I was.
You never got a chance to explain.
So when I was leaving the room, I saw the one guy who was writing down what I said. He was talking on the phone. And I just hoped to heavens that he was telling him where I was. Turns out he did.
Yeah.
He was a good sport about the whole thing, I guess. And so anyway, these two policemen in shackles took me back again through the courthouse. It was a very humiliating experience.
Was there a hearing?
Not then.
No.
Not then. So then I was taken back in the van and we started driving out of town. And I knew the town well. And we started driving past the airport and out into the desert. And I had this feeling that, oh my God, this must be where they take people and kill them. And no one ever knows what happens to them. So we just drove and drove, and through the front window of this van, the sides were solid. I saw a sign coming up, and I strained to look at it, and the sign said, Al-Wathba Prison. And I thought, oh, my God, they're taking me to prison. I thought to myself, too, this is no way to treat a visitor to this country.
No. How do they take it to prison without a hearing?
That's just the way they do it.
Oh, they can do whatever they want to do.
They can do whatever they want to do. Yeah. I have no rights there, basically.
Well, so this is like Turkey.
Yeah.
I mean, you violated one of their laws, and they there's nothing democratic about it, of course.
Nothing at all.
And there's no parliamentary procedure.
Nothing.
So what's the structure? Until
you're proven innocent, you're guilty.
Oh, because somebody found something on you, and you admitted it anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So now how did you get to court?
Well, after they took me to the prison, that first night they put me in a holding cell, and a guard came and got me later, and he said, Ameriki. And I said, yeah. He said, come. So we went back to the front office of the prison. And I thought, well, the embassy's here. They got me out. I'm going home.
Oh, good luck.
Yeah. So I got up there, and all there was his telephone sitting on this empty desk and about 10 policemen sitting around. He said, embassy. So I got on the phone. It was a lady from the American embassy. And I said, oh, I'm so glad to talk to you. And she says, Paul, we know this is very stressful for you. You have signed a document. There's nothing we can do to get you out of there. And at that moment, my heart really sank. She said, we'll be out to see you on Wednesday. It was Monday at this day. Wednesday was the normal visiting day for embassies to come to the prison. She says, we'll be there Wednesday. Just do the best you can until Wednesday. So they took me back to the cell, and they processed me for prison.
Yeah. So did Wednesday come and go?
Wednesday came and they were there. They showed up and I was escorted down to the interview room. And the two folks from the embassy came, and they just said, Paul, this is a very difficult situation. The charges are very grave. And they said to me, you can get 15 to 20 years for what you've done. And I just...
What did you tell them? Somebody planted it on you?
Well, I told them the story.
Well, of course, but you had the urine test.
I had the urine test, and I admitted it. And they said, what you have to do now is just go through their judicial system. It's their country. We can't do anything about the judicial system.
And so what do? They assign you to prison?
They put me in one of the blocks in the prison.
For how long?
Well, I was there 7 months before I got to see a judge. And in the meantime, I got a lawyer. The embassy brought a list of lawyers, and they cannot tell you which one to pick. And they said, here's a list of lawyers that we know about. I said, I'll pick that one, first one on the list. And they said, okay, we'll contact him. And he came out to see me a few weeks later, and he could not speak any English. He had a friend that could barely speak English, and all he could get out was that I was going to get 7 to 20 years, and he'd do his best to make it as minimal as possible. And it was just a trying time because my family would be devastated. And
did they come to visit you?
My family?
Yeah.
My brother came after my sentencing.
Which was how long? How long were you sentenced
to? My first visit to the courthouse was after 7 months.
Yeah.
It was about 5 minutes. Then a month later, it was 5 minutes, then 5 minutes, then a half an hour.
So how long was the sentence for?
Sentence was for 4 years. I got the minimum.
Did they give that time to count the time that you already were in?
They did.
Yeah, that's good for them.
Yeah.
How fair.
How fair. And you know, and as it was explained to me, was that 4 years was better than getting nothing, because if I had gotten set free, then the public prosecutor would have appealed and it could have been a lot worse. So I got, as it turns out, the minimum based on the fact I used it, and using was the minimum sentence of 4 years. You could have smoked one joint and you got 4 years.
Yeah.
And this country is known for reaching beyond its borders to prosecute people. If I'd come into the country having done something in another country and they suspected I'd, say, smoked marijuana, and they tested my urine and it tested positive, they could throw me in the prison for 4 years for doing it in Amsterdam, for heaven's sakes, where it's legal.
Oh,
and anyway, I got the four-year minimum sentence, and over there you get a year off of that for good behavior. So basically, if I was a good boy, I'd get 3 years.
And you did.
I was a good boy.
Yeah. Well, you wanted to get out of there.
So I got I was out after 33 months.
Yeah.
And typically what happens is that once you get your sentence, if you're a Westerner, the embassy goes to the royal family and says, you know, he's really sorry, his family's sorry, and as a country, we apologize for what he did. That's not what we do. And they let you go. So my brother came after my sentencing, went with one of the embassy staff to meet one of the royal family members, high ranking, and made a plea. And he said, I think I can help you. And over there, they never say yes or no. They say, I think we can help you, inshallah, means God willing. And then you wait.
These are Muslims, right?
These are Muslims.
Yeah.
And you wait and you wait. And after 2 or 3 weeks, nothing happened. And I knew I wasn't going to get out of there at that moment. And then it just dragged and dragged. The embassy made overtures. The ambassador himself made overtures at all the functions, the embassy parties or whatever.
Wow. So you got a book.
So I wrote a book about my experience.
Did you write while you were there?
Well, as it turns out, it kind of in a roundabout way I did when I got out of prison. All the people I'd sent letters to, without my even thinking about asking them to do this, had saved every letter I had sent.
So you had all your documents.
I had a stack of documents. Wow. When I got out, which I put in chronological order and wrote my book.
Hold on for a minute. You have no right here, you know. The Joey Reynolds Show, Paul Cesari, is here. Be right back.
710 WOR. Real life, real people, real talk radio.
I have a great friend, Harvey Rockman, who's down in Key West, Florida. Now, Paul Cesari, who's the author of You Have No Right Here, he went down to Key West, Florida. I guess you got directly there right after the Mideast when you were out of prison, right?
I took about 4 months after I got out of prison to visit people who had supported me while I was in prison. So
yeah.
I took a road trip and visit as many as I could, and then I relocated to Key West with the intent to write my book.
And having been a former stockbroker, so was Harvey Rockman, who's down there. And Harvey has financial background. Of course, he puts film deals together. And he, you told him your story, and you did a book on it, and I'm sure that he's going to make a movie out of it. So we call Harvey. Harvey, are you there? Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Splendid.
Yeah, now, you know, you always find these great, great themes, and this one is a spectacular story because Paul Cicero was treated in a Muslim prison better than Americans are treating the Muslims in Guantanamo. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And Paul's humility and the grace with which he was obviously imprisoned, he's not bitter, he doesn't seek revenge. It's a tremendous lesson for any spoiled bourgeois people in the West or elsewhere to be thankful for every moment you breathe and every day that you have of freedom. That's the message of his imprisonment.
Is that how you feel, Paul?
It is. And, you know, it's kind of ironic because about 3 or 4 weeks into my imprisonment, I was looking through a newspaper, and there was a small article that I saw talking about a theory that a gentleman from Phoenix, Arizona had developed, and it was called the adversity quotient. And I read it, and what it said is, your adversity quotient is directly proportional to how you deal with adversity, which means that if you can separate a dramatic problem in your life from the rest of your life and not let it control your whole life, then you've got a high adversity quotient. You can deal with it. And you need to let it go, not let it interfere with the rest of your life, not let it consume you, and get on with your life. And I took those words to heart. It was like those were planted there for Paul Cicero to read in preparation for this long ordeal in prison. And I went in with a strong faith, as it turns out, and I think that had a calming effect on me too. I just figured, I'm here, I got to deal with this, how am I going to do it? And I can, I saw so much fighting going on around me. You know, in this prison, there were people from Pakistan, India, all the Arab countries from Africa, and they brought their jealousies and pettiness from their countries inside the prison. There were Pakistani tribal people fighting other tribal people, and same with Indians versus Pakistanis. And I just kind of observed this as an aside and just watched this game being played inside the prison. And it was like a sideshow. And I just sort of stepped back from the whole thing and just took a deep breath and said, I don't need to get involved in this. And watching all this kind of helped me too, that, you know, let them get involved, let them cause the problems, and I'll just stay out of the way. And so a lot of things that contributed to it. And the embassy said, Paul, just be a good boy, basically, and hopefully we can get you out. So I held on to this dream that I would be released soon, which never really happened.
Well, you got out.
Eventually.
You did. I mean, 3 years and out.
And I got out with my health. And
so how do you feel when you see what's happening with other prisoners and other situations and that part of the world?
Well, there were a lot of prisoners that were there that didn't have representation from the embassy the way I did, especially people from the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan. There were just so many of them. Their embassy just couldn't deal one-on-one with them like the American embassy did. And you know, this was my first experience with law enforcement whatsoever, aside from a speeding ticket. And the embassy, you know, I got to give them a lot of credit. They went to bat for me. And it was explained to me that my timing was not good for this to happen because as I was going into prison, the ambassador was leaving his post. And as he was leaving his post, he gave a speech talking negatively about their judicial system.
Oh, boy.
So it was like bad timing all the way around. And I think the reason I didn't get out any earlier was because they were just trying to make a point that you can't tell us what to do.
The best thing's going to happen here is a good movie. Harvey, you going to put a deal together here for this guy?
Oh, definitely. He's written a screen adaptation of the book, and he met this morning with Jack Chartoff, who's a friend of mine in New York. And he's also met with Eleanor Peel to help write her story. So, Paul...
Civil Liberties Union. Well, I want to thank you for bringing us Paul, because he's a real gift, and you do great work, Harvey. Thanks for bringing all these great people to the show.
My pleasure.
And to the American public, so we can learn that there's more than one way. And, you know, all roads lead to, not hell, all roads lead to something good. Paul Cicerie, you can get his book, You Have No Right Here. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Be right back.
710 WOR. Real life. Real people. Real talk radio.